Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books and Genocide Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host today, Jeff Bachman. Thank you all for listening. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Jeffrey Osler about his new book, Surviving Genocide, Native Nations in the United States from the American Revolution to Bleeding Kansas, published by Yale University Press in 2019. This is a really remarkable book that I look forward to discussing with our guest on today's show. Jeff Osler, welcome to the show. Jeff, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Thanks very much, Jeff, for inviting me. I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah, and did my undergraduate work at the University of Utah in English. I got a master's degree at the University of Oregon, where I teach now, and then my PhD in history, University of Iowa in 1990.
Great, thank you. And how did you become interested in studying genocide?
Probably in around the year 2000 or so. I was finishing a book called The Plain Sioux and U.S. Colonialism that was published in 2004. And as I was thinking about that book, it ends with the Wounded Knee Massacre, fairly well-known event in 1890. And, there was a question in my mind about whether that event itself qualified as an act of genocide. I didn't directly address that in the book, but it got me thinking, and I'd always been interested in this question about the extent to which what happens to Native Americans of North America is genocide. I'd always been interested in debates about that. Writing about the Wounded Knee Massacre got me more interested in thinking broadly about this very question, the question of genocide in American history.
So, and we'll definitely get into the book, but what you said just made me think of something I saw in an article that you had published with Journal of Genocide Research, and you noted that you were using Frank Chalk and Kurt Jonassen's definition of genocide. Does the definition we use have an impact on whether we recognize some of the indigenous genocides as such?
Yeah, I think it certainly does. One of the things that I did in the book was I didn't really start out with providing the reader with any particular definition of genocide. People may know, for example, of Ben Madley's book, An American Genocide, about what happens in California. And Ben, I think it's a very good book. I have no criticism of it. What Ben did is take the UN definition of genocide, the well-known 1848 UN Convention definition, and sort of apply it as a template. And I didn't want to really do that. What I wanted to do was to raise the question of genocide at various points along the way, invite the reader in, as it were, to a discussion, rather than to set out a particular definition, the UN definition or any other one, as a kind of template. And so I wanted to sort of invite the reader in on it as a discussion. And I do wind up arguing that genocide is certainly very much a part of the history that I'm writing about. But I do it in a somewhat different way. I don't know how effective that will be, but that was the choice that I made.
Great, thank you. And we'll definitely come back to that, because I know that at the end of your book, you talk about how your ideas around sort of labeling treatment of Indigenous peoples, how that evolved. But before we get to that, can you tell us how you came to write this book in particular?
As I say, I had become interested in the question of genocide through thinking about the Wounded Knee Massacre. But what I decided to do was to explore that question. You know, we've had in the last 30 or 40 years just an enormous outpouring of work about the history of Native people that eventually come under the United States. You know, the so-called New Indian History arose in the 1980s. And we've had, you know, we have shelves and shelves of wonderful books. But what I thought was that what we don't have was a kind of overview, as it were, a kind of comprehensive overview of, you know, putting a lot of the work that we have together and then saying, let's create a comprehensive overview of what really was the impact on Native American people of U.S. expansion, if you will, or to put it in another way, what was the impact of settler colonialism. So that was what I tried to do in this book, was to give what we don't have, a comprehensive, I mean, it can't be completely comprehensive, but at least a somewhat comprehensive overview.
In the way you just described your book, you referred to Native nations. And at the start of Surviving Genocide, you include a note on terminology. And terminology seems, you know, especially important in terms of, you know, the right way or most respectful or most, you know, to refer to people the way they want to be referred. And so why is it so important, and why are some terms more problematic than others when referring to Native nations?
Yeah, no, it's exactly right. I mean, you want to be respectful always of what people themselves wish to be referred to as. And it's complicated. In my book, I'm probably writing about 40 or 50 Native nations, maybe more. And the terminologies for specific nations have changed. A lot of Native people got called names that in the earlier period that were not correct. I mean, they were maybe imposed on them by outsiders. They were distorted in some way or another. So a good example of this would be the Winnebago Nation. And they, you know, for quite a while now, have gone on record as wanting to be referred to as the Ho-Chunks. I mean, that's in their own language is their name for themselves. So, you know, when I wrote about them, I used that term, and there were many other similar examples.
Thank you. So, you know, beginning in the 16th century with your work and working forward to the mid to late 19th century, while generally maintaining a linear timeline with some shifting, did you confront any challenges to covering such a vast history of events and ideas?
Yeah, I did. The geography of the book covers mainly the eastern part of the United States, east of the Mississippi River, which is a big geography. And then because I take up the policy of Indian removal that was enacted formally in 1830, and because eastern nations were moved west of the Mississippi, the geography also involves a little bit of the territory west of the Mississippi. And so that it's a huge geography. I mean, it's sort of half a continent. And it did present some real challenges. One of the ways that I tried to meet the challenge of being clear as I was moving around different parts of the eastern part of the continent, as I was moving around, one of the things that I felt that I needed to do was to provide the reader with maps. Some people have a good sense of geography, others less so, but so they could follow as I was moving around. So I hope that works. Fortunately, the press was great about this. They wanted me to have maps, and I think there's probably 2022 maps in the book. And so I'm hoping that that will help readers sort of navigate what is a quite complicated geography, many nations, people moving around a lot, and so on.
I personally found the maps very helpful in sort of visualizing the geography of the where you were working on. So thank you for including them. Somewhat related question to the last one. What were the major historical moments and turning points that shifted relations, whether improving or, upsetting relations between colonists and Native nations? You highlight the Proclamation of 1763, there's Independence, the Northwest Ordinance, the Indian Removal Act, as well as many others. Can you talk a little bit about how these sort of episodes shifted these relations?
In the episodes that you mentioned, Jeff, let me take up a couple of them. One would be the Proclamation of 1763. This is where the British Empire drew a line roughly at the crest of the Appalachians and prohibited settlement west of there. The British Empire was never going to make that a permanent line. Native people thought that it would be and certainly thought that it should be, but it certainly did have the effect of slowing down settlement. And it also had the effect of making speculation in lands west of that line uncertain. So there are many, many people, well-known Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, who were speculating in lands in the West, and their title was uncertain because of the Proclamation of 1763. And I think really the significance of this isn't something that is new with me. I mean, I'm just drawing on what a lot of scholars have pointed out. But this, I think, is quite important for understanding why the colonists revolted against Great Britain, is that, Great Britain was blocking what they sensed ought to be their freedom to have these lands. So, when I talk to my classes and ask students, well, why is it the American Revolution occurred? Of course, people will immediately say taxation without representation. Certainly that's real. But I also think a very important factor is, perception on the part of the colonists that they're entitled to Western lands and that the crown is blocking them. So that's very important, the 1763 proclamation, its consequences. The other turning point that I would highlight would be the Indian Removal Act of 1830. That momentum for that had been building for a long time. I mean, one of the things I argue in the book is that this policy in 1830 didn't just show up suddenly. It wasn't Andrew Jackson was president and pushed it forward, but it wasn't just Andrew Jackson's baby. Other presidents had advocated for it. They were preparing for it to happen. It wasn't practical to start really moving the Eastern nations west until around this time when it did pass in 1830. And, you know, as I looked at the consequences of the Indian Removal Act, where there were the removals of multiple communities over several decades, and also there were the removals of communities living west of the Mississippi River. We very seldom think about them, but it wasn't an empty wilderness out there. There were indigenous people in the areas that they were going to, you know, force the Eastern people into, and so they had to remove or dispossess those nations. And so as I looked at the consequences of that policy on the nations in the East, and how successfully or unsuccessfully they were able to rebuild in the West after they were removed, and also the impact of the policy on the nations in the West already, what I was struck with was by how really destructive this policy was. And it's not like we don't know some of that. I mean, people know about the Cherokee Trail of Tears, and it's routinely mentioned, you know, that 4,000 or so of the 16 to 20,000 Cherokees moved west died. That's a staggering figure in itself, but I don't think we have a full sense. And what I tried to convey, one of the things I tried to convey in the book, is a full sense of the massive destructiveness of this policy on Indian nations in the South, Native nations in the North, and also those already west of the Mississippi.
You know, maybe somewhat relatedly, I'm not sure of the exact origin, but I was going to ask you if you had any input on the cover image. You know, the art itself is beautiful, and it's at the same time, it's very unsettling because of what it depicts. Did you have any input on that?
Well, I did. You know, the press did ask me for some suggestions, and at first I wasn't really sure. I had located an image that I was going to use internally in the book, and at one point it occurred to me that that might be a very good cover image. And the image, and the press then got permission to use that image as the cover and designed a cover using that image. The image, I think, is very striking. It's a 1965 watercolor by a Choctaw artist named Valjean Hessing. And it's of the removal of the Choctaw Nation out of Alabama west into what becomes Oklahoma. I just think it's a very compelling image. I think it's an image about survival. I think that, you know, that's what Choctaws are having to do is they're moving west. It's the real possibility, and they sense this at the time, that they're moving into a land of death. And that their nation may cease to exist. And as they're moving west, I think that their challenge is, you know, to survive that, to overcome that. There's going to be massive loss of life. There was, but one can see also the survival that the artist is representing. So I'm glad you appreciated the cover. I mean, if there's one good thing about the book, I think it's the cover. I really do like that that image, and was glad we were able to use it.
I like it too. Again, for both its beauty, but also the, you know, what it represents and the depiction of the people. And I do want to come back to this, the importance of emphasizing resilience and survival of Native nations. But just taking a step back to your research for a moment, what role did working with primary documents and the voices in the writings of Native peoples play in shaping your research journey?
Yeah. You know, as I mentioned earlier, Jeff, you know, the project is a general overview, and it draws on the work of many, many scholars. But I also, you know, worked in particularly published primary documents. I didn't really visit archives. It was impractical to do that. But there's a, you know, huge archive of primary sources that one can fairly easily obtain. And there are a couple of things that I really saw in those primary sources that I tried to highlight. One of them was the many, many times in the historical record when leaders of Native nations, Native confederacies that emerge that are trying to resist U.S. settler colonialism, Native people saying many, many times something to the effect of the Americans or the colonists, we know what they're up to. And what they want to do is they want to take our lands. And in order to do that, they want to kill us all. They want to extirpate us. Well, they want to exterminate us is often the language that comes out. These are translations of what people are saying, but it's very clear in the record that that's what they're conveying. And so I came to term that an indigenous consciousness of genocide. And I think that that's really in the sources quite consistently, is that that's what many Native people, you know, think the U.S. project is it is a fundamentally genocidal project, that that's what they're up against. And, you know, then they're having to think about how, you know, to avoid that happening. So that's one of the things that I think comes through in the documents I worked with. And another thing that really comes through to me that I also tried to highlight is as the U.S. policy of Indian removal is developing and being implemented, Native nations say many, many times to U.S. officials through petitions, through speeches, and so on, many, many times they say essentially, don't do this to us, we will be damaged. And they will say, you know, you say that you're doing this for our own good. And that, of course, was the rhetoric by U.S. officials about Indian removal, that it was necessary to do in order to save, quote, save Native people from an otherwise inevitable fate to disappear. You had to move them west. And, you know, Native people would be constantly saying no. The only way for us to survive, if you really care about us, is to let us stay where we are. And if you move us, it will be very destructive. And so they understood that, and they foresaw what in fact did happen. And so I think that's a very important voice to recognize. It's a voice that U.S. officials at the time completely ignored. And to some extent, historians sense have ignored it. And, you know, I think that it really should be highlighted when we think about the policy of Indian removal.
Thank you, Jeff. You know, connected to this idea of saving them and this sort of benevolence of U.S. officials, you talk about, you know, the quote unquote like good faith negotiations and offering Native nations quote unquote reasonable terms for their lands, and how these, you know, establishing the good faith negotiations of the U.S. officials would then be used to essentially justify quote unquote just and lawful wars when the Native nations resisted, you know, selling or turning over land to U.S. officials and to colonists. Can you talk a little bit about this? This is something I find really interesting in my own interest in what I think is a shared relationship between war and genocide that goes beyond just sort of shared time and space and actually where the violence itself tends to blur lines. So could you talk a little bit about these quote-unquote just and lawful wars and how they were justified by U.S. officials?
Yeah, for sure. Here's what I have to say about just and lawful wars. The phrase comes from the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. And as you and I'm sure many listeners know, what the Northwest Ordinance did was set up a framework for admitting states in the Northwest Territory. The states eventually admitted were Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan and Wisconsin. The idea was that they would be admitted on an equal footing is what the Northwest Ordinance calls for, and it creates provisions for that. So, you know, it's a, I think, fundamental settler colonial text is foundational to the U.S. about how the U.S. is going to organize these territories. Well, these are Indian lands that are going to be become territories and eventually states brought in the United States on an equal footing. The Northwest Ordinance does have a clause in it about Indians, and it pledges the utmost good faith will always be shown to the Indians. And then it says that they will not be disturbed except in just and lawful wars authorized by Congress, is what the language says. Historians haven't really looked at what just and lawful wars actually mean there. Historians will often quote the utmost good faith clause because it seems to show a kind of humanitarian intention that that a lot of historians like to highlight, coming out of the revolution and in to the early republic. But what I argue is that to understand what these clauses mean, you have to really look at what's going on the ground. And so, you know, the United States is trying to take the lands of Native people in order to, you know, create territories and states. The way it's going to do this is through treaties. And so it goes out and sends treaty commissions to the various nations out in the West. And it says to them, here are the treaty terms. We believe we're acting in utmost good faith in providing you with some assistance to become civilized if you'll give up a good portion of your land. And what the United States would like is for Native nations to simply agree to that right away. In fact, many of them don't. And then the United States says, well, we're going to put pressure on you to agree to these terms. And so they use a variety of what I think are really ultimately quite deceitful mechanisms to coerce, and I think there is always coercion, the agreement of at least some leaders, most of whom probably really don't have the authorization by their people to cede lands. That then leads many Native people to believe that treaties that the United States now declares have been fairly negotiated. In other words, the treaties have been treaties that have reflected utmost good faith. But many Native people don't see those treaties as anything like that at all. They actually see them as fundamentally illegitimate. They understand the techniques that have been used to coerce a kind of assent by some people. And so what those people do is that they began to organize multinational confederations of resistance. And they say, we don't think the treaties are legitimate. We don't think we've given up our land. And if you start sending settlers into here, or if you start sending troops into here, we'll resist. And so it's at that point that the United States says, look, on our terms, we've shown utmost good faith. And you guys are rejecting reasonable terms. You have no basis for your claims. And so now we're going to declare war on you. So that's where just and lawful war on U.S. terms would come in. The United States declares that the war is going to be just and lawful. But I don't really think it is. I go on to say, let us look at the kind of war that the United States will prosecute against Native resistors. And I do believe that it is a distinctive kind of war. It's a war against, quote, uncivilized people, or war against, you know, Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration about the merciless Indian savages. And war against those people, the United States believes, doesn't have to conform to the kind of international rules that you would apply to war with, quote, civilized people. And then I think what the kind of war that they pursue against resisting native people is genocidal war. That is to say, war that involves, an attempt anyway to surprise and destroy entire villages, of hundreds or even thousands of people, and to kill as many people as possible. Perhaps take a few people as hostages, but largely indiscriminate killing, which, in my view, meets a fairly common sense definition of genocide. There, I don't think the definitional question becomes particularly challenging when you're talking about that kind of warfare.
Thank you, Jeff, for addressing especially that last bit, because some might respond, well, war is war, genocide is genocide. What made this war genocidal? And I do think you very sufficiently, cover that in your book. A question I have for you, in the book, you quote Thomas Jefferson a number of times. And, at a time when within the last, 5 to 10 years, there's been movements for, statues and other things to come down based on historical racism and other things. Through your research, do you think that we need to rethink how we celebrate some of our historic figures as related to their roles in the treatment of indigenous peoples in the United States?
Yeah, I do think so. And I think there's some discussions of that are going on. They've been going on for a long time. Indigenous people in California particularly have protested, some of the statues that commemorate the missions. Here on my campus, we have a pioneer statue. There's some discussions about what that statue represents and celebrated at the time. And, whether we want to keep that up there or maybe move it to a museum where we can contextualize it and educate people about what its purposes were at the time. So I do think that there are, and I think we're going to see more discussions about this. Discussions about Confederate monuments, I think, have stimulated this, but a lot of people are saying, we've got a very serious problem, with celebrating the Confederacy, but isn't it an equally serious problem to be celebrating American leaders who, for example, spoke of the desirability of exterminating indigenous people? Jefferson talked that way, something that I think we need to think about more.
Thank you. And I think these protests are testament to something else, which is, connected to the title of your book, Surviving Genocide, that Native peoples are, protesting against the commemoration of some of these individuals. Why were some Native nations better able to avoid or resist their own destruction than others?
Yeah, that's a very interesting and frankly a challenging question. And it's something that I did as I was writing the book think about, and I have some things to say. I think there's two factors. One is location. So at certain periods in the history, I think depending on where people were, they were just simply more subject to forces of destruction. So to give an example, during the period of removal in the 1830s and 1840s, the nations that were forced to move were those that were in the path of demand for their land by either enslavers in the South who wanted to extend the Southern cotton plantation regime, or in the North, in a different version of settler colonialism, one that was centered more on free labor and independent freeholders, but those people want land as well. But there were some areas where those lands weren't in such demand yet. And so, for example, settlers started moving north into the lower peninsula of Michigan, fairly early after the War of 1812, and were moving up the lower peninsula. In 1837, there was a financial panic, and that sort of deterred settlers from continuing to go north. And so when you get up into the upper part of the lower peninsula and then the upper peninsula, then when you get into some of the areas of Wisconsin, you don't really see huge demands on those people's lands. And so the pressure on them for removal is not as intense. Now, there are treaties that are forced on them that require them to cede some of their lands. This is to some extent anticipating future settlement. It's also because people are starting to want their resources, particularly their timber resources. And, it's not that they don't suffer during this period, but they aren't forced out of their homelands. And so location does become a variable. I also think there are cases where some nations have exceptionally good leadership, which allows them to maintain some internal cohesion that allows them to survive some of the disruptions better. And one example I give in my book that I think fits this is a rather small community of, a few hundred Kickapoos. There's other Kickapoo communities, but there's a particular Kickapoo community in Illinois led by a man named Kennecuck, who seems to have, I don't know if it's exactly him or his people collectively working with him, but they seem to have maintained a community cohesion, and they are forced to Kansas, what eventually becomes Kansas. But it seems that they don't lose a significant portion of their population, and that they're able to rebuild an agricultural economy under difficult conditions without significant loss of life. Lots and lots of the other nations have significant loss of life that are moved into Kansas. And, I wouldn't want to, in saying, this Kickapoo community had, I think, exceptional leadership. That's not to say, all these other nations that suffered much larger losses somehow had bad leaders, and that's what explains it. That would, be blaming the victim or something like that. I mean, people are being subject to such forces of destruction, that it is a miracle that survival occurs at all, given what's happening.
Connecting that to the sort of survival or resilience narrative, why is it important that we do emphasize, especially non-Native peoples, to emphasize the resilience and survival of Native individuals, avoiding turning them into victims? And, some of these nations are still facing, threats of their existence today. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point, Jeff. One of the things that I mentioned, the new Indian history starting in the 1980s, one of the points that has been stressed from that point on in the literature is, we need to create narratives that do not depict Native people as victims. Or sometimes it's put in terms of, we don't want declension narratives. We know that settler colonialisms goal, you know, we know this particularly from, you know, the Australians like Patrick Wolf and Lorenzo Veracini have called this to our attention. You know, the goal is to eliminate Native people by one way or another. And one of the ways of eliminating Native people is ideologically or rhetorically or discursively by portraying them totally as victims who have disappeared. And even in quite sympathetic accounts of, say, the 19th century and the experience of Native people under the U.S., one can get narratives that do produce this sense that, you know, Native people were destroyed, that they ceased to exist. And of course, this is so important to counter. You know, we need to recognize that we have close to 600 federally recognized tribes and many other tribes that aren't federally recognized, but have, you know, tribal integrity, have the attributes of sovereignty, which ought to be recognized. And, you know, we need to know that, you know, the history I'm writing about was a horrific history in for many people, but that people did survive and they continued to face terrible challenges in the 20th century. But there's been a resiliency and so many Native communities have rebuilt their populations. You know, there's been a resurgence in Indian country. It's often dated, you know, to the late 1960s, 1970s, that has many aspects and manifestations. One most recently, you know, is the movement at Standing Rock of water protectors against the Dakota Access Pipeline. So, you know, we need to recognize a continuity between, you know, survival, as I'm talking about it, and many other people in the 19th century, and then, you know, to the future, where we have things like what we saw at Standing Rock.
Thank you, Jeff. We begin to wind down here. You began to address this a little bit at the start of our conversation, you know, using the term genocide to refer to the treatment of Indigenous peoples in the United States. At the end, when you do give an overview of the genocide and Indigenous peoples in the United States debate, you mentioned that your own perspective evolved. Why did that happen? Or how did that happen?
Yeah, you know, in a way, it was an evolution. It was also a kind of back and forth. You know, the primary goal of the project was to give an overview of the impact of the United States as it was expanding on Native nations, and that involves understanding what they were doing, you know, to counter adverse impacts. And I often thought of, you know, because as you know, and many listeners will know, the debate about, you know, what qualifies as genocide, what the proper definition of genocide is, in many, many cases, not just in North America, but, you know, in many cases all over, you know, is very contentious. And there is a proliferation of definitions and always debate about those. And so, you know, I was sometimes thought, well, maybe the best thing to do is not even to address, not even use genocide at all one way or another, but just talk about forces of destruction was the term that I often used. And, you know, I use that term in the book as well. You know, but in the end, I did think that genocide was a part of the history that I was writing about. It was a big part of the history. You know, genocide wasn't happening every day. It wasn't happening to all of the different Native communities that I was writing about all the time. But it was consistently there in various ways, you know, as a process, as a reality, and certainly, as I've said, as something to be survived. So in the end, you know, what I've tried to argue, and I think, you know, some Native people feel that writing their histories in terms of genocide can be a problem because it risks, you know, inscribing them as victims, as we were just discussing. So, you know, I didn't want to write a history that was just genocide, genocide, genocide. But I also, and, you know, there, as I say, many parts of the history where genocide isn't occurring and there's other things that are going on. But I think it's against the background of the threat of genocide, you know, which is more or less ever present and then certainly does occur at various points and through various processes. So for better or worse, you know, that was the way that I wound up doing it.
Thank you. And you mentioned that, you know, some of your listeners or some of our listeners and I might know about some of the things that you're referring to, at least on a certain level. Beyond that, who is your audience? Who do you want to read this book?
Well, you know, I'd like people who are interested in Native American history, interested in U.S. history, both academics, but also, you know, people of the reading public to find the book valuable. You know, a couple of other points. You know, I think Native people, you know, understand and, you know, they have instructed me on this point. That, you know, there is genocide in their history. And, you know, I think of themselves, I don't want to speak for everybody, but many people I do know, it's often said, think of their communities, as having had to survive, a genocidal process. And so, you know, that consciousness of genocide, I think is very much present still among Indigenous people. So I don't feel that I have anything to tell them that is completely new. But, you know, I'd like to think that in some of the details, in the analysis of U.S. policy, in the information that I presented, that there will be a value for readers who already kind of know the basic punchline, as it were. But that in the details, the specific information, there'll be some value. You know, for non-Native readers, some of them also will understand some of this history. So the same thing would go there. But many readers, I don't think, have, you know, fully reckoned with, you know, the history that I'm trying to bring to light here. You know, that... American democracy, you know, as I argue and as I believe, when it was set up, theorized, when it was put into practice, you know, American democracy fundamentally depended on the taking of the lands of Native people. You know, the early founders recognized this. You know, you had to have, they said, a continuously expanding supply of land in order to create the conditions for democracy, which in their view rested on, you know, a pretty large portion of the white population being independent property holders. That was a kind of requisite for political participation. So to get that, you had to take Native lands. Not sure people recognize that, broadly speaking. And, you know, I'd like to see that more broadly recognized, and then also to see a broader recognition of the costs of that. You know, what were the costs of that for Native people?
And also, you know, thank you for all the time you gave us today. Before we do let you go, can you tell our audience about what will be covered in the second volume of this two-volume set? I don't know if we mentioned it at the start, but you know, you do write that this is one of two volumes. And is this what you're currently working on now?
Yeah, right. You know, originally, when I started in on this many years ago, I thought, you know, writing a book that would cover the impact of U.S. expansion on Native nations from the Revolution, really up to, say, the early 20th century, you know, when sort of continental expansion is complete, as it were. And, you know, along the way, I just realized that I couldn't fit this into a single volume. So, you know, I divided it into two. So the one that I finished, as I say, you know, ends out in sort of Kansas, Oklahoma, that area. And then the next volume will focus mainly on the American West. You know, I'm currently working, for example, on the Pacific Northwest, particularly the impact of the advent of commercial capitalism on the Northwest coast in the 1780s, 90s, and early 19th century, when, you know, U.S. shipping interests, commercial interests were coming out to the Northwest coast and making arrangements with Native communities who were hunting sea otters. And, you know, the sea otter pelts were then sold into China as part of the China trade. So, you know, there's a lot to think about there in terms of violence, in terms of new diseases, and eventually in terms of land loss. So, you know, the Northwest will be part of it, the Plains, the Southwest, California, and so on.
Great. And do you have a general idea of when this might be coming to publication? I know this one was just published, so it might be a little bit of a little time down the road.
Yeah, I wish I could do it. You know, I started writing this book. I put pen to paper, as they say, in the fall of 2010. That was a long time ago. And, you know, I'm getting older, so I'd better do it sooner than I did the first one. You know, but, you know, gosh, it's hard to say, isn't it, how long these projects take?
It sure is. Well, Jeff, you know, thanks again for your time. I do look forward to volume two when it does make it to publication. And thank you. And maybe we'll have you back when that time comes. And take care.
Okay. Thanks very much, Jeff.